Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. We will continue to bring you any developments as soon as they happen in the transit situation. Again, if you haven't heard, a strike has been called against the Triborough Coach and Jamaica bus line serving Queens and the Bronx. And President Toussaint of the Transport Workers Union says this will be the first of a series of strikes if there is no agreement with the MTA. Talks are expected to continue, and so far we are hearing that the drivers have not actually walked off those buses. So a lot of mysteries remain. We have reporters out trying to figure it all out and stay on it. So we will continue to update as warranted here on WNYC. But for right now, think government eavesdropping is just for suspected foreign terrorists? Well, think again. The New York Times reports today that the president authorized the National Security Agency to carry out spy operations on Americans. The NSA usually just works overseas or on foreigners. And the paper reports the agency monitored phone calls and emails of perhaps thousands of people inside the country in the past 3 years. That agency is usually known for its foreign operations. And according to the Times, it would be the first time their attention was directed domestically, raising questions of whether this is legal without the necessary court authorization. But the role of intelligence agencies has been reframed in many ways since 9/11. So is this kind of action justified if it helps prevent the next attack? Well, joining me now to talk a little bit about this, but in a more broad sense about the evolving role of intelligence agencies and being a spy, is a former CIA agent. Lindsay Moran was lured to the agency by the glamour and adventure she found as a kid in James Bond movies, but she left after 7 years after her dreams amounted to something more banal when she started to work as a spy. Her book is called Blowing My Cover, My Life as a CIA Spy, from Berkeley Books. Lindsay Moran, welcome back to WNYC. Thanks for coming on.
Thank you for having me.
First, a little bit about you. You went to Harvard, did well enough that you got to give a speech at your graduation, and the next day applied to work at the CIA. An unusual career path for any Harvard kid.
Well, in actuality, working at the CIA had been a lifelong dream of mine, one that I kind of kept to myself and shared with my immediate family members. But this was something that I had wanted to do since I was a very little girl.
You didn't tell your Harvard classmates about your spy dreams? You thought it would be politically unacceptable?
Not that I thought it would be politically unacceptable, but I harbored this dream that someday I would actually work there, and I thought if it ever comes true, I don't want to be in the position of making my cover story even harder than it actually is to maintain. So I never told anyone that I was going to apply to the CIA, and then, of course, never told anyone when I actually started to work for the CIA.
And a good bit of your book is about how hard it is to maintain your cover and the difficulties of having a personal life while being a CIA agent. Some of the funnier parts have to do with your relationship with your boyfriends at that time. What did you tell your boyfriends?
I usually told them that I worked for the government and that I had a very boring job, that I was involved in writing reports and reading reports. And this was following some explicit instructions from the CIA. They told us to make ourselves sound as boring as possible so that people wouldn't ask questions. And I found that, you know, it worked very well in terms of maintaining my cover, but it didn't do much for my love life when I was trying to come across as the consummate drip.
So you actually got training from the CIA on how to mislead your loved ones.
Exactly. I mean, I think that all of us who joined the agency expected that, and I think many of us, myself included, were already very adept at lying. But one of the things that you find when you work for the CIA is that you lie to maintain your cover and you lie for your job, but it inevitably seeps into your personal life. That is, you end up lying about everything because it's so easy to lie and because you need to lie about so many things. It ends up basically permeating every aspect of your life.
You wrote that your neighbors thought you were a high-end hooker.
My mother's neighbor, in fact, approached my mother and said, you know, we can't figure out what's up with your daughter. She's traveling all the time. She seems to have plenty of money, and she's very evasive whenever we ask her questions. I think you might want to consider that she might be a high-end call girl. And my mother just responded by laughing, and I told my mother, well, at least she thought I was a high-end call girl.
Did your mother know what you were really doing?
My mother knew, my father knew, and my brother knew. So my immediate family members knew. My grandmother didn't know, and she's still alive. And now that I've left the CIA, she's convinced that the CIA is going to come after me and assassinate me.
How did your mother feel about that intervention by the neighbor that she was trying to help and warn her? Or how dare you be so nosy?
My mother was very, very professional, I guess, and helpful about maintaining my cover. That is, I told my mother at the beginning, you know, she loves to chit-chat. So I think it was difficult for her to not be able to tell anyone what I was doing. But I told her at the beginning of my career at the CIA, I said, you really can't tell anyone, Mom, because this could have implications for my safety and implications for national security, and that was enough for my mom.
But knowing the truth, how did she feel when that neighbor revealed her suspicions to her? How did she feel about the neighbor?
I think she probably was above all amused by it. And I think retrospectively finds the whole situation amusing, that she's sort of a typical Jewish mother who wants to brag about her kids. And she had me in the CIA and my brother a Navy pilot, not exactly the professions that she could brag about.
Lindsay Moran, my guest on WNYC, author of Blowing My Cover, My Life as a CIA Spy, now out in paperback. And back in April, you wrote an op-ed criticizing the CIA for the way it hires clandestine agents. You said they put too much of an emphasis on hiring the fully fledged Americans rather than people of Middle Eastern descent who might be actually more useful to the agency. Does that thinking stem from a concern over patriotism?
I think it stems in from a concern over patriotism, but also the CIA is naturally very distrustful of foreigners, to include second-generation Americans. And I think that they have yet to achieve the right balance of security, valid security considerations when you're hiring a foreigner or someone of foreign descent to work at the CIA. And the real need we have for people who have language capabilities in some of the difficult languages and who are able to culturally assimilate into the societies that we need to break into in order to infiltrate terrorist networks. And the CIA has not, in my opinion, achieved that right balance. You know, if you go to a typical CIA meeting, it's going to be a sea of white faces there.
As you know, in the news today, there's the White House agreeing to back a measure by Senator John McCain, finally, that would ban cruel, inhuman, and degrading treatment of prisoners in American custody, not just torture. How are the two things different? How are the four things different from your understanding as a CIA agent? And of course, the controversy was whether this would apply to the CIA and not just the military. Does this have a practical meaning to you, the line between something called torture and something called cruel, inhuman, or degrading?
Well, I think that both of them should not be means that we use to gather information. And I think that anyone who is familiar with intelligence and how we gather intelligence would argue that the most effective way to gather intelligence is never going to include either cruel and inhumane treatment or torture. That's not a way to... You might get information, but 9 times out of 10, it's not going to be quality information. It's not going to be what we call intelligence. And aside from that, I think that were we to exempt CIA officers from a ban on torture or cruel and inhumane treatment, we put them at a great risk. That is, many CIA officers are serving overseas, and that puts them at the risk that if they're ever captured, they might be subjected to that kind of treatment and would have no defense.
In fact, in your book, you describe how in training to be a CIA agent, you went through capture and interrogation yourself for several days, and they do this with CIA agents in training as if they were prisoners. What techniques did they use there?
They used techniques, I think, to humiliate us, some physical techniques, you know, knocking us off chairs. I think there was one woman I describe in the book who was so outraged, she was hit a couple of times and ended up threatening to sue the CIA to the point that I don't know that they actually use that faux POW camp experience anymore.
And, of course, that wasn't to simulate what they do, at least in theory, but it was to simulate what might be done by some bad guy.
Right. It was to create a situation to put us under a tremendous amount of pressure and for us to be able to see how we would react. And I think in that respect, it was incredibly helpful. But what was interesting to me was how quickly the line between make-believe and reality was blurred, and how quickly people did break down and become very emotional and upset after being humiliated both physically and psychologically. And this was in a training scenario. So it dawned on me that in a real-life scenario, people would break down very quickly and probably tell their torturer or their interrogator anything that he or she wanted to hear, and it would not necessarily be true information.
And in fact, we have this story recently about that man named Al Libby, not Louis Libby, who gave bad information under coercion about Al-Qaeda Saddam Hussein connections before the war, which turned out to be fabricated by him as he was being, I don't know if tortured is the right word or not, but something that would be banned under this, apparently, before the war.
Yeah, and I think that's a perfect example of showing, you know, you can put physical stress on someone, you can humiliate them, and eventually they'll say something, but that should not be the means that we rely on to gather intelligence. It's not an effective means, and I also think it degrades what this country stands for. You know, we have always been, I think, considered unique in our in the breadth of civil liberties we have and in our respect for human rights, and we're seeing increasingly an erosion of that. And that's very alarming to me.
Former CIA agent Lindsay Moran, my guest on WNYC, her book Blowing My Cover, My Life as a CIA Spy, now out in paperback. Let me ask you about this story on the front page of the New York Times today that's getting a lot of attention about the National Security Agency. And I know you were a CIA officer, not with the NSA, but you were an intelligence official involved in spying. How much would this be a shift from previous government policy if the NSA was in fact spying on Americans domestically?
Well, I think that this represents a drastic shift. I mean, as much as I criticize or find fault with the CIA for a number of things, one of the things that I enjoyed about the agency or respected about the agency was that it was very clear when we were working for the CIA that we were spying on foreigners. And if there was ever a situation where we might find ourselves spying on American citizens, that was a big deal. And we had to figure out how to tackle that problem without spying on Americans. That was not in our purview. It's not supposed to be in the purview of the NSA. So I think this would be a drastic shift in policy, and again, one that's very alarming.
Why is it alarming?
Well, I think it's alarming because the NSA, the CIA, the FBI, all of these intelligence organizations exist in part to protect our American way of life, which again, traditionally has had a wide breadth of civil liberties. And now we're seeing a situation where we're putting security over our civil liberties. And this is a public debate that we haven't had for the administration or the president to unilaterally decide that security is more important than civil liberties. I don't think that's within the right of the president or the administration.
Well, that's a nice debate to have in the abstract. But the Times did report that this NSA program helped to uncover a plot by an Ohio trucker planning to blow up the Brooklyn Bridge. And that person, Iman Faris, was a naturalized citizen, and he pleaded guilty in 2003 to supporting Al-Qaeda. Does stopping something like blowing up the Brooklyn Bridge, if in fact this NSA program did that, make it worth the breach of that line?
Well, I think that we have in place laws that enable us or enable the FBI or the NSA to monitor American citizens or people on American soil when there is evidence that it can prevent a terrorist attack or when there is evidence that they are involved in foreign intelligence activities.
Because I think in this case, all we're talking about is having the NSA spy on this guy. We're not talking about torturing him or anything like that, as far as I know, in this article. And reportedly, it may have helped to stop an attack on the Brooklyn Bridge.
And if that's the case, I think under certain conditions, obviously it's necessary and understandable that the NSA would have to monitor emails or phone conversations. But to sort of across the board give the NSA either the ability or the mandate to spy on Americans is something that I think would rightfully make many Americans very uncomfortable. Again, you know, we have to have that debate about which is more, in the age of terrorism, is it more important for us to safeguard our civil liberties, or is it more important for to us to have a very aggressive security service?
I gather you knew Valerie Wilson when you were a CIA agent?
I didn't know her personally, but I knew of her and had colleagues who worked with her and worked under her.
So at the time she was outed in Robert Novak's column, is your understanding that she was undercover or wasn't undercover? Because that seems to be the source of rhetoric, if nothing else, in Washington.
Well, there's been an argument made that she wasn't undercover because she was working at Langley. And I think that argument shows a limited understanding of how the CIA works and how the clandestine service works. That is, anybody who's undercover will inevitably have a stint at Langley, especially someone like Valerie Plame, who had, you know, a 20-year-plus career. So my understanding was that she was undercover. And one thing that I don't think has been highlighted in this case is, you know, it's a tragedy for Valerie Plame in terms of her career as a covert officer is over, but it's also a tragedy for the CIA and the country. People like Valerie Plame, who have 20-plus years experience, do not grow on trees. And so it's a tremendous loss to the Directorate of Operations, the CIA's clandestine service, that we would lose such an officer with her name being leaked.
You left the CIA partly because you opposed the Iraq War. Did you witness any manipulation of intelligence with regard to Iraq?
No, I did not. But I will say, and I describe in Blowing My Cover, how when I was working on Iraqi operations from Langley at the time during the war, everybody I talked to who was an expert in this area at the CIA maintained to me that we didn't have any evidence of WMD and that we certainly didn't have any evidence of a link between Iraq and al-Qaeda. So it was astounding to me, the disconnect between what I was hearing at the ground level at the CIA and what I was reading in the paper and hearing from the administration.
So how do you explain then CIA Director George Tenet telling the president that the case was a slam dunk?
I was as shocked by that comment as I think anyone else from an insider's perspective, and was sort of waiting for the day that George Tenet was going to say, I didn't actually say that. Well, he never did, leading us to believe that he did tell the president it was a slam dunk. All I can say is that from the analysts that I spoke to and also the operations people who had worked on this issue for over 10 years, it was a known fact at the CIA that we didn't have the evidence to suggest that Iraq or Saddam Hussein was an imminent threat. And we certainly did have the intelligence to suggest that it wasn't going to be a cakewalk
in
Iraq.
We just have 10 seconds left. Do you think then that Tenet was just telling the president what he wanted to hear?
I do. I think they had a very close relationship, and I think at the end of the day, Tenet's loyalty was to the president above the people under him at the CIA.
Former CIA agent Lindsay Moran, her book Blowing My Cover, My Life as a CIA Spy, is now out in paperback from Berkeley Books. Thanks so much for coming on with us.
Thank you.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC.